Hello, welcome to Voice on Record on Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. Today's programme is pretty random, actually. Just really going to give you a selection of all sorts of things that I've been listening to recently and various odd bits and pieces that perhaps I haven't been able to fit into previous shows. So we'll start with something which has actually been requested, and I was going to play this as a sort of a bridge between the children's records episode and the electronic music concrete avant-garde music and sound and voice show. It sort of crosses over, but only really by name, and as soon as you hear the little theme tune, I'm sure you'll recognise what's coming next.
This story is about the Moog, a simple soul, the Moog. That day, he was going nowhere in particular, which is where he went quite often, when it happened. And then again. It was obvious, even to the Moog, that he must do something about it, so he did. Oh, that was much better. No, it wasn't. Then who should come up but Mavis Cruitt, the fairy, followed by the caterpillar called Arthur.
Here, what's bitten the old Moog?
He's just having a little scratch, Arthur, said Mavis. I expect he's got a little tickle. You've got a little tickle, haven't you, Moogy dear? Perhaps he's got
a flea?
Shh! Arthur!
What's wrong with having an old flea?
Well, nice people never have a you-know-what, so we don't talk of such things.
Oh, I see. So the old Moog here has got a you-know-what. Hey, Moog, have you got a you-know-what?
No, Arthur, I've got a flea.
Oh, the disgrace!
Then who should come along but Car Wash the cat?
Tell me,
said Car Wash,
do I see the Moog, jiving? Or is he, bee-bopping? My eyes are not first class, you know. Perhaps this animal intends to star in some discotheque.
The Moog is not dancing, Car Wash. He has a...
Oh, how very irritating for the poor fellow.
Perhaps the you-know-what will get giddy and fall off.
If I do, I'll hop on to one of you lot.
Hey, I never knew the old Moog was so clever. He said that without moving his lips. Moog, say bottle of beer.
Bottle of beer.
His lips did move, Arthur.
I think I'll hop onto the caterpillar first. He looks nice and tasty.
That was not the voice of the Moog. That was the voice of the parasite on a Moog's back. Oh, well, I think it's a flea, and I wish he'd hop it.
And have me for afters. No, you keep it, Moog, mate. Try to think of it as your own little pet.
Well, the poor Moog would have had his little pet forever if it hadn't been for Mavis Cruitt.
I am going to magic the you-know-what and make him vanish.
Now, vanishing is what people do before Mavis waves her wand. Her magic nearly always goes wrong.
Now, Mr. You-know-what, vanish! Oh, crumbs! I've made him grow bigger! Mr. You-Know-What, come back!
For the next few days, that giant flea terrorised everyone.
Well, one bite from him, mate, and you'd lose an arm.
Quick, everyone, run!
Ha-ha!
Well, once again, that little Mavis Cruitt saved the day.
Fear not, Arthur. I shall wave my little magic wand and turn that horrid you-know-what into something.
That would be nice.
Now, what shall I turn him into? I know. I turned him into a vegetarian. said Mavis.
There's the quite brilliant Kenneth Williams there in 1981, reading, of course, from Willow the Wisp. Now, there's something quite strange that happens on this next recording. It's not that strange, and it's actually very, very common. If you listen really carefully, hear it in all sorts of recordings. But if you do a recording on tape and you don't wind it end outwards, then sometimes you get print through, and that's when the reels of the tape next to one another, the magnetism, the magnetic field sort of prints through from one reel to another. So what you actually get is a sort of a delay effect. And if you listen very carefully to the very beginning of this, you will hear print through. Now, that's what's doing it. Feel free to email me and tell me I've got it wrong. I'm sure there are some far more knowledgeable engineers out there who can probably give me all sorts of explanations, and I'd love to hear them as well. So if you've got any different theories or practice or knowledge, then drop me an email, and the email address is voiceonrecord@gmail.com. So here's Joyce Grenfell.
Children, now come along. We're going to do our nice moving to music this morning. So let's make a lovely fairy ring, shall we? And then we'll all be flowers growing in the grass. Now let's make a big circle. Spread out. Wider. Wider, just fingertips touching. That's it. Sue, let go of Neville. Well, because flowers don't hold hands, they just touch fingertips. Sue, let go of Neville. And Sue, we don't want grumblers in our fairy ring, do we? We only want smilers. Yes, David, you're a smiler. Yes, Lavinia, you are, and Peggy. Yes, you're all smilers. Now, quiet, please. Don't get so excited. Now, quiet. And Sue's going to be a smiler in a minute, aren't you, Sue? That's better. George! Don't do that. Now then, let's all put on our thinking caps, and we'll think what flower we're going to choose to be. Are you ready? Lavinia. A bluebell. Good. Peggy. A red rose. That's nice. Neville. A wild rose. Well done, Neville. Sydney. Sydney, pay attention, please, and don't pummel Rosemary. What flower are you going to choose to be? A horse isn't a flower, Sydney. No, children, that isn't funny. It's very silly. And if Sydney can't think of a better flower than that, I think we'll go on to somebody else until he can. Now then, Sue, what about you? Another rose. Oh, I've got a lovely bunch of roses, haven't I? Peggy's a red one, and Neville is a wild one, and I expect you're a beautiful white one, aren't you? Oh, you're another red one. All right. Now then, Sydney. A carrot isn't a flower, Sydney. Now think, dear, and don't blow like that. How about being a tulip? Well, a holly leaf isn't a flower, Sydney. All right, you be a holly leaf. Now then, children, listen very carefully. Elvis, stop bouncing. No, bouncing isn't dancing. Elvis, don't argue, dear. Now, you watch the others and you'll see. Now, when Miss Bolting plays her music, I want us all to get up onto our tipmost toes, light as feathers, and dance away all over the room wherever the music takes us. And remember, we're lovely flowers growing in the grass. Everybody ready? Oh, just a minute, Miss Bolting. Sydney. Sydney, come here, please. What have you got in your mouth? I can't hear a word you're saying, Sydney, so go out of the room and spit it out, whatever it is, and then come back and tell me what it was. And Sydney, both feet, don't hop. Now then, we're not going to wait for a silly little boy who puts things in his mouth like a baby. We're going to be lovely flowers growing in the grass, and the sun is shining down on us to make us grow tall. And Geoffrey, stand up, dear. Flowers don't look backwards through their legs, do they? What flower are you? A fat daisy, are you? Well, that's nice. Now, Hazel, what do we do with our heads? We hold them up. I should think so. Come in, Sydney. Come in. There's no need to knock the door down like that, is there? Now, what did you have in your mouth? It can't have been nothing, Sydney, because I distinctly saw something. Yes, I know it's nothing now, but what was it then? A big button. Well, I'm very glad you spat it out, aren't you? You didn't? Well, do you feel all right, Sydney? Well, get back into your place, then. Where did you get the button from? Off Rosemary's pink frock. I'm ashamed of you, Sydney. A big boy of four to go around eating buttons off little girls' frocks. What flower are you going to be? I've quite forgotten. You better be a hollyhock. Sydney, you cannot be a superjet. And if you're going to be a crosspatch, you better go and sit down over there until you're a nice boy again. And you'd better be thinking what flower you're going to be. And then you can go on. Go and sit there. And then you... George! Now then, children, we're ready. Now listen carefully to the music and then dance like a flower. And we're ready at last, Miss Moulting. I am so sorry. One, two, off we go. Dance, Neville. Don't just stand there. Hazel, dear, use your arms. Don't forget to breathe, Peggy. Breathe, dear. George, rhythm. Yes, you can. Cheer up. You're a happy flower. Yes, you are. Because I say so. Oh, good, Sydney. I knew you'd think of something you'd like to be. All right, you shall be a cauliflower. Only be it gently.
And then from one lovely bit of piano accompaniment there to another. And the next pianist you'll be hearing is Michael Garrick, and this is another track from a record I played a couple of weeks ago. This is from the world of Stanley Holloway, somebody who I don't really know much about and hadn't really heard of before. It shows my ignorance. But this is an Argo record from 1971, and this is a track called Brown Boots. And this is what Stanley has to say about it on the sleeve. Brown Boots is rather different from the other monologues. When I was a very young man, many years ago, a friend of mine was a stonemason, and he told me that a fellow came up to him one day and said that he wanted a stone put up for his late wife. When he was asked how much he wanted to spend, he said, "I don't care, give us a blooming elaborate one. She was a blooming lady." And that's what their attitude used to be. They always had the black horses with the black plumes. A Cockney funeral was a terrific thing. So when this fellow turned up in brown boots to a Cockney funeral, it was the funniest thing in the world. It has laughs and a bit of pathos, and that's the value of the number.
Our old Anna's passed away. We'd her funeral today. And it was a posh affair. Had to have two policemen there. The hearse was lovely. All plate glass. What a coffin. Oak and brass. With thousands weeping. Flowers galore. But Jim, our cousin, what do you think he wore? Brown boots. I asked you. Brown boots. Fancy coming to a funeral in brown boots. I'll admit he had a nice black tie, black fingernails and nice black eye. But you can't see people off when they die in brown boots. And aunt had been so very good to him, done all what any mother could for him. And Jim, her son, to show his class, rolls up to make it all a farce in brown boots. I asked you, brown boots, while all the rest wore decent black and mourning suits. Although he didn't seem so gay, in fact he cried best part of the way. But straight, the regular spoiled our day with his brown boots. In the graveyard we left Jim. None of us said much to him. Here, we all give him the bird. Till by accident we heard he'd give his black boots to his pal, Jim Small, a bloke who got no boots at all. So perhaps Aunt Anna wouldn't mind. She did like people who was good and kind. But brown boots. I asked you, brown boots. Fancy coming to a funeral in brown boots. And we could hear the neighbours all remark, "What him chief boulder, what a blooming lark. Why, he looks more like a bookmaker's clerk with his brown boots." That that's why we was all so very rude to him. That's why we never even said I do to him. We didn't know. He didn't say. He'd give his other boots away. But brown boots, I asked you, brown boots, while all the rest wore decent black and morning suits. But someday, up at Heaven's Gate, poor Jim, all nerves, will stand and wait till an angel whispers, come in, mate, where's your brown boots?
You're listening to Voice on Record on Resonance FM, 104.4 FM and resonancefm.com. Now, later on in the show, I'm going to play quite a long part, which is the first part of a serialisation of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, which it features Paul Scofield as Thomas Becket, Cyril Cusack, Julian Glover, Michael Gwynn, Alec McGowan, Patrick McGee, Glenda Jackson, and directed by Howard Sackler, and many other people in the cast. And it's a great recording. That will be serialised over the next four episodes of Voice on Record. There's also a competition, our first, very first inaugural competition in today's show, and that will be appearing later on. But now, from the sublime Stanley Holloway to the ridiculous Blaster Bates, this is by special request.
What with this... the advertising job, you get all sorts of jobs to do. And a bloke rang me up, he said, hey, come and blow us a strong room. You know, so we've got a bank strong room we want blowing. I thought, oh, this is it. All these years I've been waiting for one of these buggers. Me in the white suit in the Argentine, you know. I said, how much is in it, you know? And then he said, don't talk like a twat. You like, come out of that tree and I'll talk to you, sort of thing. I said, what's the carry on? He said, we're altering the premises for hump batches in Hanley, middle of Hanley there. And the store came up the street and up to the bank and over the bank, and the bank was shifting their little premises onto the other corner. He said, we've got to alter the premises to make it all into the one shop. Will you come up and blow the strong... We've hit the strong room, we can do now with it. So he goes up there the next morning. When I got there they heard, took the front window out and they got some planks in to get in with the wheelbarrows, and they've been chommering away at the corner of the strong room for a week and knocked about hatful off, you see. So I said, have you got the key? You know. Not that we need it, but it saves explosive, you know. He said, aye. So we go in the strong room. I thought, well, just the job, because it's a room in a room, you see. Five courses of engineering brick with strips of steel down and a concrete lid on the top. So you get in the room and drill one wall. Put a dozen in this wall, give it a fair bloody thrutching, and that'll knacker that, you see. And then do the other wall at the other end, and then add the roof on with acros and do the others and do the roof last, you see. So we got into the... And just as I was going to go in there, young Hunt Batch comes up. Now, he's a round tabler. And I'd been to their round table about a month previously, and he looked at me, and he went all pensive-like. He says, Christ, he said, they've not sent for you. I said, they have. Absolutely painless. You won't need an anaesthetic for this. He said, me bloody shop. Don't worry. You go and have your cup of coffee and forget it. Anyway, somebody led him off. Went in, drilled it, put the explosive in, let these dozen bits of fuse come out into the street. And then they started Vroom, 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 like that, you know, makes your bloody teeth chatter for a minute. And the pigeons took off and did a couple of laps. And the Bobby was standing on the edge of the pit. He pulled his helmet over his eyes, you know. And the last one went, and all the dust was coming out, and the lads went in there, hee! And there the wall is a steaming ruin, you see, hanging on bits of metal. Hee, bloody lovely, hee, we can have this in the wheelbarrow now. Gosh, so I thought, I'm not going in there with all, because it gets in your navel and, you know, behind your ear, and up your nostril. And just then, your unbatch come up, and he's all smiles. He said, by God, he said, you've helped us out this morning. And I said, I'll say, you wouldn't have had this department open for Christmas. She said, I'm not talking about that. I said, what are you talking about? She said, you realise you're working directly underneath the ladies' underwear department? I said, so what? Oh, she said, we've had one in this morning. Our manageress, she had a hell of a time with her. 3/4 of an hour. She tried all the rubber corsets. When she went in there, she come out of here. When she went in there, the bloody sand run to the bottom. She said, we got the 36-guinea whalebone and string, and she couldn't get them to meet. And that first shot went off. Oh, my God! She was in, laced up, and out of the bloody shop in 4 minutes, she said. Come and pick yourself a suit. But then, with the advertising, of course, you'll always get the other bloke come up to you. We want a lake depth charging. You know, I said, depth charging, what for? He said, we've got pike in it, he says. I said, well, what do you want me to depth charge? He said, we want all the pike killing. Depth charge the buggers, he says. He said, we've tried netting it. You know, he said, but with the undulating bottom, you see, the buggers go under the net. He said, we netted it and we thought we got them all out. Then we put some pike bait in there and we caught 3. He said, and we're going to stock it with trout. He said, and if we put young trout in there, they'll go through them buggers like a dose of salt. See, we put about 150 trout in, we'll finish up with one big fat pike, you know. he said, it's no use to us, that isn't, you see. So he says, I wonder if you could come and depth charge the buggers. I said, oh, I'll depth charge them, all right. He said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. It's up the other side, St Asaph, he says. He said, if we come for you on Saturday morning, you can use my Land Rover. He said, we're a syndicate of 2. He said, you use my Land Rover and we'll go in the car in front and you follow us and we'll show you the way. You can put all your explosive in my Land Rover. I said, that suits me. So he come on the Land Rover and he got out the Land Rover and got in the car with the other bloke, you see, and they went away. And I'd got put my explosive in, and I followed them up, chased them up the road, and every time I looked like catching them up a bit, they'd shoot off again, you know. A good 2 mile in front by the time we got up to St Asaph, and up the bloody mountains we went, and went up to this place, and when we got there, it was a beautiful place, 4.5 acre lake, and it was about, on an average, of 18 foot deep. And in one or two places, it might have been 25 or 30 foot deep, these holes in it, you see. And a couple of days previously, when I was talking to him about it, I said, now, one of you'll have to row the boat, you see. Get me out there, and then I can depth charge, chuck the jet charges over the back, and we can row down, and then they'll detonate, and we can kill the bloody pike. So when they got out the car, instead of the 2 getting out, there was 3 got out. And one fellow was a little inoffensive bloke, you know, letting the world go by, minding his own bloody business, you know, having a good look. And they took him to show him the lovely scenery, you know. That's what they bloody codded him on with. And as soon as I said, which of you buggers is rowing the boat, the big un grabbed some rushes and some straws, and they started drawing bloody straws. Now, I could have safely put £100 down and said that little fellow had got the short straw. He was taking what they call for the ride, you know. I said, it looks as though you're in the boat, mister. He said, well, it is that the stuff there. And I got the nice big £10 sticks. It saves tying 2 £5 ones together. And just to make sure, give it some bloody hammer, you know. But £10 stick, 18 foot on the bottom, I'll bring rocks up as big as that chair, you know. Hell of a lot of woof with it, you see. So I just got them all fused up, nice pile of them in the back of the boat. He said, by the way, he said, what happens if that goes off? I said, well, me and thee won't feel it anyway. I said, you do get a feeling of well-being just for that millisecond. I said, it doesn't really hurt, you know. Oh, he's looking at it. I said, do you think you can manage? Oh, aye. He said, so he rose off to the middle. I said, just steady it up a bit. But on the back there, lit the fitter fuse and plunk, a lovely big 10-pound stick, plunk in the water, and it leaves a trail of bubbles where the fuse comes up, you see. And because it burned quite well underneath, under the water, you can't put it out once you've got it lit. And I said to him, row. And I could feel the boat shake. I could feel the boat shaking and all like that. But the bloody bubbles weren't dropping astern at all. And I thought, by God, well, this isn't a time to be hanging about. So I said, row. And he's rowing all right. When I look round, he's going like buggering. But the oars weren't even in the water. The bubbles had fascinated him like a bloody snake. And he was scratching away like an old hen. I said, for Christ's sake, get him in the water and row. But by God, when he got a minute, he's blue. Oh, I didn't got going up. I could keep dumping the odd one in, you see. Well, there's always that time lag for the first one. But when you've lit the next one and tossed it in, there's only about 2 or 3 seconds between them, and then they start going off. Boom, and then they boom, boom. Christ, he said they're catching us up. Oh, dear. Oh, I do believe he finished up with a double hernia.
There's the infectious laughter of Blaster Bates, and that's especially for Outer Spaceman. There we go. Now, coming up for the competition. A couple of shows ago, 3 or 4 shows ago, I played some Ludwig Koch. Now, this is another side, this is a B-side of a talking book record, which is called Birdsong by Ludwig Koch. And in this record, in this recording, there is a bird singing. And that bird has another name. And that other name is the name of an album by a rather wonderful English singer, artist, guitar player. If you can name that artist and that album, you stand to win a CD recording of Speaking Personally, Aldous Huxley, which was the interview recorded by Lansdowne Records with Aldous Huxley in 1961. Several times I've played excerpts, and no doubt I shall play some more. But that's what you stand to win. So if you can recognise that and email voiceonrecord@gmail.com with your name, and you stand to win. I shall draw the names out of a hat and announce the names, name of the winner in the show before Christmas. So there we go. You need to name the artist and the album title that relates to one of the other names of one of the birds in this excerpt. So listen carefully to Ludwig Koch explaining what's happening.
Starling song. Starling spring note. Starling mimicking blackbird. Blackbird alarm note. Blackbird extreme alarm. Young blackbird in nest. Blackbird song. Song thrush, call note. Song thrush, song. Missile thrush in thunderstorm.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the selection of British bird song there presented by Ludwig Koch. Now, coming up is the first part of Murder in the Cathedral. Apart from the acting and the plot, and if you're not sure about it, then find it on the net, find a précis and brush up on it. And it's worth looking into. But check out the sound effects and the music behind the chorus of women, especially, which is about the sort of after about 5-10 minutes of it. It's just breathtaking. Eerie atmospheric sound design of the first order. Anyway, Murder in the Cathedral by T.S. Eliot.
Here let us stand close by the cathedral.
Here let us wait.
Are we drawn by danger?
Is it the knowledge of safety that draws our feet towards the cathedral? What danger can be for us, the poor, the poor women of Canterbury. What tribulation with which we are not already familiar?
There is no danger for us, and there is no safety in the cathedral.
Some presage of an act which our eyes are compelled to witness has forced our feet towards the cathedral. We are forced to bear witness.
Since golden October declined into somber November, and the apples were gathered and stored, and the land became brown, sharp points of death in a waste of water and mud, the new year waits.
Breathes.
Waits. Whispers in darkness.
While the labourer kicks off a muddy boot and stretches his hand to the fire, the new year waits. Destiny waits for the coming.
Who has stretched out his hand to the fire and remembered the saints at All Hallows? Remembered the martyrs and saints who wait.
And who shall stretch out his hand to the fire and deny his master?
Who shall be warm by the fire and deny his master?
7 years and the summer is over. 7 years since the Archbishop left us, he who was always kind to his people.
But it would not be well if he should return.
King rules or barons rule. We have suffered various oppression, but mostly we are left to our own devices, and we are content if we are left alone. We try to keep our households in order.
The merchant, shy and cautious, tries to compile a little fortune.
And the labourer bends to his piece of earth, earth colour, his own colour, preferring to pass unobserved.
Now I fear disturbance of the quiet seasons. Winter shall come bringing death from the sea.
Ruinous spring shall beat at our doors.
Root and shoot shall eat our eyes and our ears. Disastrous summer burn up the beds of our streams.
And the poor shall wait for another decaying October.
Why should the summer bring consolation for autumn fires and winter fog? What shall we do in the heat of summer but wait in barren orchards for another October?
Some malady is coming upon us.
We wait.
We wait.
And the saints and martyrs wait for those who shall be martyrs and saints.
Destiny waits in the hand of God, shaping the still unshapen.
I have seen these things in a shaft of sunlight.
Destiny waits in the hand of God, not in the hands of statesmen who do some well, some ill.
Planning
and guessing.
Having their aims which turn in their hands in the pattern of time.
Come, happy December.
Who shall observe you?
Who shall preserve you?
Shall the Son of Man be born again in the litter of scorn?
For us, the poor, there is no action.
But only to wait and to witness.
7 years, and the summer is over. 7 years since the Archbishop left us.
What does the Archbishop do, and our Sovereign Lord the Pope with the stubborn King and the French King, in ceaseless intrigue, combinations, in conference, meetings accepted, meetings refused, meetings unended or endless at one place or another in France?
I see nothing quite conclusive in the art of temporal government, but violence, duplicity, and frequent malversation. King rules or barons rule. The strong man strongly, and the weak man by caprice. They have but one law, to seize the power and keep it, and the steadfast can manipulate the greed and lust of others. The feeble is devoured by his own.
Shall these things not end until the poor at the gate have forgotten their friend, their father in God, have forgotten that they had a friend?
Servants of God! And watchers of the temple, I'm here to inform you without circumlocution The Archbishop is in England and is close outside the city. I was sent before in haste to give you notice of his coming as much as was possible, that you may prepare to meet him.
What, is the exile ended? Is our Lord Archbishop reunited with the King? What reconciliation of two proud men?
What peace can be found to grow between the hammer and the anvil?
Tell us, are the old disputes at an end? Is the wall of pride cast down that divided them? Is it peace or war?
Does he come in full assurance or only secure in the power of Rome, the spiritual rule, the assurance of right and the love of the people?
You are right to express a certain incredulity. He comes in pride and sorrow, affirming all his claims, assured beyond doubt of the devotion of the people, who receive him with scenes of frenzied enthusiasm, lining the road and throwing down their capes, strewing the way with leaves and late flowers of the season. The streets of the city will be packed to suffocation, and I think that his horse will be deprived of its tail, a single hair of which becomes a precious relic. He is at one with the Pope and with the King of France, who indeed would have liked to detain him in his kingdom. But as for our king, that is another matter.
But again, is it war or peace?
Peace, but not the kiss of peace. A patched-up affair, if you ask my opinion. And if you ask me, I think the Lord Archbishop is not the man to cherish any illusions, or yet to diminish the least of his pretensions. If you ask my opinion, I think that this peace is nothing like an end, or like a beginning. It is common knowledge that when the Archbishop parted from the King, he said to the King, "My Lord," he said, "I leave you as a man whom in this life I shall not see again." I have this, I assure you, on the highest authority. There are several opinions as to what he meant, but no one considers it a happy prognostic.
I fear for the Archbishop. I fear for the Church. I know that the pride bred of sudden prosperity was but confirmed by a bitter adversity. I saw him as Chancellor, flattered by the King, liked or feared by courtiers in their overbearing fashion, despised and despising, always isolated, never one among them, always insecure, his pride always feeding upon his own virtues, pride drawing sustenance from impartiality, pride drawing sustenance from generosity, loathing power given by temporal devolution, wishing subjection to God alone. Had the King been greater, or had he been weaker, things had perhaps been different for Thomas.
Yet our Lord is returned. Our Lord has come back to his own again. We have had enough of waiting from December to dismal December. The Archbishop shall be at our head, dispelling dismay and doubt. He will tell us what we are to do. He will give us our orders, instruct us. Our Lord is at one with the Pope and also the King of France. We can lean on a rock. We can feel a firm foothold against the perpetual wash of tides, of balance of forces, of barons and landholders. The rock of God is beneath our feet. Let us meet the Archbishop with cordial thanksgiving. Our Lord, our Archbishop, returns. And when the Archbishop returns, our doubts are dispelled. Let us therefore rejoice. I say rejoice and show a glad face for his welcome. I am the Archbishop's man. Let us give the Archbishop welcome.
For good or ill, let the wheel turn. The wheel has been still these 7 years and no good. For ill or good, let the wheel turn. For who knows the end of good or evil until the grinders cease and the door shall be shut in the street? And all the daughters of music shall be brought low.
Here is no continuing city.
Here is no abiding stay.
Ill the wind.
Ill the time.
Uncertain the profit.
Certain the danger.
Oh, late.
Late.
Late. Late is the time.
Late.
Too late.
And rotten the year.
Evil the wind and bitter the sea and grey the sky.
Grey, grey, grey.
O Thomas, return, Archbishop.
Return, return to France.
Return.
Quickly.
Quietly. Leave us to perish in quiet.
You come with applause, you come with rejoicing, but you come bringing death into Canterbury.
A doom on the house.
A doom on yourself.
a doom on the world. We do not wish anything to happen.
7 years we have lived quietly, succeeded in avoiding notice.
Living and partly living.
There have been oppression and luxury. There have been poverty and license. There has been minor injustice. Yet we have gone on living.
Living and partly living. Sometimes the corn has failed us. Sometimes the harvest is good. 1 year is a year of rain, another a year of dryness. 1 year the apples are abundant, another year the plums are lacking. Yet we have gone on living.
Living and partly living.
We have kept the feasts, heard the masses. We have brewed beer and cider, gathered wood against the winter, talked at the corner of the fire, talked at the corners of streets, talked not always in whispers.
Living and partly living.
We have seen births, deaths, and marriages. We have had various scandals. We have been afflicted with taxes. We have had laughter and gossip.
Several girls have disappeared unaccountably, and some not able to.
We have all had our private terrors, our particular shadows, our secret fears.
But now a great fear is upon us. A fear not of one, but of many. A fear like birth and death, when we see birth and death alone, in a void apart.
We are afraid in a fear which we cannot know.
Which we cannot face.
Which none understands.
And our hearts are torn from us, our brains unskinned like the layers of an onion. Ourselves are lost.
Lost in a final fear which none understands.
Oh, Thomas Archbishop, oh, Thomas our Lord, leave us and leave us be in our humble and tarnished frame of existence. Leave us. Do not ask us to stand to the doom on the house, the doom on the archbishop, the doom on the world.
Archbishop, secure and assured of your fate, unafraid among the shades, do you realize what you ask? Do you realize what it means to the small folk drawn into the pattern of fate? The small folk who live among small things. The strain on the brain of the small folk who stand to the doom of the house, the doom of their lord, the doom of the world.
Oh, Thomas Archbishop, leave us.
Leave us.
Leave sullen Dover and set sail for France.
Thomas, our Archbishop, still our Archbishop, even in France.
Thomas Archbishop, set the white sail between the grey sky and the bitter sea.
Leave us.
Leave us for France.
What a way to talk at such a juncture! You are foolish, immodest, and babbling women. Do you not know that the good Archbishop is likely to arrive at any moment? The crowds in the streets will be cheering and cheering. You go on croaking like frogs in the treetops. But frogs at least can be cooked and eaten. Whatever you are afraid of in your craven apprehension, let me ask you at the least to put on pleasant faces and give a hearty welcome to our good Archbishop.
Peace, and let them be in their exaltation. They speak better than they know and beyond your understanding. They know and do not know what it is to act or suffer. They know and do not know that action is suffering and suffering is action. Neither does the agent suffer nor the patient act. But both are fixed in an eternal action and eternal patience, to which all must consent that it may be willed, and which all must suffer that they may will it. That the pattern may subsist, for the pattern is the action and the suffering, that the wheel may turn and still be forever still.
Oh, my lord, forgive me, I did not see you coming, engrossed by the chatter of these foolish women. Forgive us, my lord. You would have had a better welcome if we had been sooner prepared for the event. But your lordship knows that 7 years of waiting, 7 years of prayer, 7 years of emptiness, have better prepared our hearts for your coming than 7 days could make ready Canterbury. However, I will have fires laid in all your rooms to take the chill off our English December, your lordship now being used to a better climate. Your lordship will find your rooms in order as you left them.
And will try to leave them in order as I find them. I am more than grateful for all your kind attentions. These are small matters. Little rest in Canterbury with eager enemies restless about us. Rebellious bishops, York, London, Salisbury, would have intercepted our letters, filled the coast with spies, and sent to meet me some who hold me in bitterest hate. By God's grace, aware of their prevision, I sent my letters on another day, had fair crossing, found at Sandwich, Brock, Warren, and the Sheriff of Kent, those who had sworn to have my head from me. Only John, the Dean of Salisbury, fearing for the king's name, warning against treason, made them hold their hands, so for the time we are unmolested.
But do they follow after?
For a little time, the hungry hawk will only soar and hover, circling lower, waiting excuse, pretense, opportunity. End will be simple, sudden, God-given. Meanwhile, the substance of our first act will be shadows and the strife with shadows. Heavier the interval than the consummation. All things prepare the event. Watch.
You see, my lord, I do not wait upon ceremony. Here I have come, forgetting all acrimony, hoping that your present gravity will find excuse for my humble levity, remembering all the good time past. Your lordship won't despise an old friend out of favor. Old Tom, gay Tom, Becket of London. Your lordship won't forget that evening on the river when the king and you and I were all friends together. Friendship should be more than biting time can sever. What, my lord, now that you recover favor with the king, shall we say that summer's over or that the good time cannot last? Fluting in the meadows, viols in the hall, laughter and apple blossom floating on the water, singing at nightfall, whispering in chambers, fires devouring the winter season, eating up the darkness with wit and wine and wisdom. Now that the king and you are in amity, clergy and laity may return to gaiety, mirth and sportfulness need not walk warily.
You talk of seasons that are past. I remember, not worth forgetting.
And of the new season. Spring has come in winter. Snow in the branches shall float as sweet as blossoms. Ice along the ditches mirror the sunlight. Love in the orchard send the sap shooting. Mirth matches melancholy.
We do not know very much of the future, except that from generation to generation the same things happen again and again. Men learn little from others' experience, but in the life of one man never the same time returns. Sever the cord, shed the scale. Only the fool, fixed in his folly, may think he can turn the wheel on which he turns.
My lord, a nod is as good as a wink. A man will often love what he spurns. For the good times past that are come again, I am your man.
Not in this train. Look to your behavior. You were safer, think of penitence and follow your master.
Not at this gate. If you go so fast, others may go faster. Your lordship is too proud. The safest beast is not the one that roars most loud. This was not the way of the king, our master. You were not used to be so hard upon sinners when they were your friends. Be easy, man. The easy man lives to eat the best dinners. Take a friend's advice. Leave well alone. Or your goose may be cooked and eaten to the bone.
You come 20 years too late.
Then I leave you to your fate. I leave you to the pleasures of your higher vices, which will have to be paid for at higher prices. Farewell, my lord, I do not wait upon ceremony. I leave as I came, forgetting all acrimony, hoping that your present gravity will find excuse for my humble levity. If you will remember me, my lord, at your prayers, I'll remember you at kissing time below the stairs.
Leave well alone the springtime fancy. So one thought goes whistling down the wind. The impossible is still temptation. The impossible, the undesirable, voices under sleep, waking a dead world, so that the mind may not be whole in the present.
Your lordship has forgotten me, perhaps. I will remind you. We met at Clarendon, at Northampton, and last at Montmirail in Maine. Now that I have recalled them, let us but set these not too pleasant memories in balance against other, earlier, and weightier ones, those of the chancellorship. See how the late ones rise. You, master of policy, whom all acknowledged, should guide the state again.
Your meaning?
The chancellorship that you resigned when you were made archbishop, that was a mistake on your part, still may be regained. Think, my lord, power obtained grows to glory, life lasting, a permanent possession, a templed tomb, monument of marble. Rule over men, reckon no madness.
To the man of God, what gladness?
Sadness only to those giving love to God alone. Shall he who held the solid substance wander waking with deceitful shadows? Power is present, holiness hereafter.
Who then?
The Chancellor, King and Chancellor. King commands, Chancellor richly rules. This is a sentence not taught in the schools. To set down the great, protect the poor, beneath the throne of God, can man do more? Disarm the ruffian, strengthen the laws, rule for the good of the better cause, dispensing justice, make all even, is thrive on earth and perhaps in heaven.
What means?
Real power is purchased at price of a certain submission. Your spiritual power is earthly perdition. Power is present for him who will wield.
Who shall have it?
He who will come.
What shall be the month?
The last from the first.
What shall we give for it?
Pretense of priestly power.
Why should we give it?
For the power and the glory.
No.
Yes. Our bravery will be broken. Cabined in Canterbury, realmless ruler, self-bound servant of a powerless pope, the old stag circled with hounds.
No.
Yes. Men must maneuver. Monarchs also, waging war abroad, need fast friends at home. Private policy is a public profit. Dignity still shall be dressed with decorum.
You forget the bishops, whom I have laid under excommunication.
Hungry hatred will not strive against intelligent self-interest.
You forget the barons, who will not forget constant curbing of petty privilege.
Against the barons is king's cause, churl's cause, chancellor's cause.
No. Shall I, who keep the keys of heaven and hell, supreme alone in England, who bind and loose with power from the Pope, descend to desire a punier power, delegate to deal the doom of damnation, to condemn kings, not serve among their servants, is my open office. No, go.
Then I leave you to your fate. Your sin soars sunward, covering kings' falcons.
Temporal power. To build a good world, to keep order as the world knows order. Those who put their faith in worldly order, not controlled by the order of God, in confident ignorance but arrest disorder, make it fast, breed fatal disease, degrade what they exalt. Power with the king. I was the king, his arm, his better reason. But what was once exaltation would now only be mean dissent.
Well, that was part one of four of Murder in the Cathedral by T.S. Eliot. You've been listening to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams, on Resonance 104.4 FM, ResonanceFM.com. www.theirishpod.com. Do join us next week for a show possibly on the Irish. It might well be time for it. And in the meantime, have a wonderful week. Goodbye.